Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
The following episode deals with mature subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
For many explorers, it was a race to see which expedition would be the first to chart and reach the Earth's magnetic South Pole. A conquest finally accomplished by the Nimrod expedition in 1909. A member of that team, 26-year-old Sir Douglas Mawson, also held that honor and place in history. A few short years later, Mawson would lead his own expedition back to that icy coastline, hoping to conduct scientific research and chart new areas. As a geologist and adventurer, he knew to plan ahead, and he had thought of every possible scenario to ensure his own safety and the safety of his team. Or so he thought. What Mawson didn't realize was that surviving the unforgiving and harsh terrain of the Arctic was something he couldn't completely plan for. In this little-known, harrowing tale, you can decide if Mawson's expedition team's survival came down to the whims of Mother Nature, or did it all come down to luck? A roll of the dice in this episode of Deadly Misadventures.
Remember the days before Instagram and crowdfunding, when people had to go out and raise money the old-fashioned way, through face-to-face begging? Mawson was being offered large sums of money from businessmen with interests in both mining and whaling. Coming off his recent success with the Nimrod expedition, which was the first of three into the great continent of Antarctica, Mawson was able to raise the modern-day equivalent of $16.7 million. This was more than enough to fund an expedition, sending himself and a team of explorers to this icy and barren continent. It was named the Australian Antarctic Expedition. The part of the coastline he intended to explore had been scouted by sea by a French explorer in 1840. But not a soul had set foot there before Mawson's expedition. His primary mission was to collect scientific data, set up radio communications, and map previously unexplored areas of this vast glacier-covered coastline. In an effort to avoid an Oregon Trail scenario, Sir Mawson knew how to properly plan for an excursion. Some might have called him a bit of an overplanner. Unlike the ill-fated three-hour tour of Gilligan's Island, he surmised his journey would take a little over a year. In the case of unforeseen circumstances, he brought along enough people and provisions to last 2 years. And that might not be enough. In today's era, he would have live-streamed the entire event on social media and linked a swipe-up post for his sponsors and donors. But this trip was old school. Their goal was to set up two-way radio communication among the three intended base camps to facilitate communication with the rest of the world. All of this in one of the harshest environments on the planet. It's hard to imagine a time when instant communication and on-demand entertainment didn't exist, unless you use Sprint and are driving across Kansas. But one thing that did still exist was sponsorship. The main sponsor for this expedition was Heinz, and they loaded up these future influencers with a lot of cans of beans and condiments. And we all know, men love their condiments. Some things are just timeless. While Mawson was still in his early 30s, he wasn't an ordinary thrill seeker doing it for the glamour. He was an accomplished geologist and a serious academic. Mawson also had very serious scientific goals and pursuits planned for this particular trip. On his previous trip, he wrote in his journal that the continent, quote, rivets our souls. This continent had also taken a few souls as well. You see, the ice in the Antarctic doesn't remain still. Glaciers are constantly moving, bending, and cracking as they push towards the sea. One of the biggest dangers is what's known as crevasses. They're wide open, vertical breaks that can be anywhere from a few feet to 65 feet wide and several hundred feet deep. They're often covered over by an accumulation of snow, which can cause what's called a snow bridge. Snow bridges can be very deceiving to the eye, as it obscures the large crevasse. They can look like solid land, but still lack any structural integrity to allow for safe crossing to an untrained eye.
On December 2nd, 1911, a vessel by the name of the Aurora entered the ice-packed natural harbor of the Antarctic. The vessel had to navigate around icebergs and jutting cliffs before entering a bay named the Commonwealth. It was there the team built a main base camp, which they called Cape Denison. After it was built, the Aurora sailed away with an anticipated return date of January 15, 1913. It was summer during the month of January in the Antarctic, providing the ship with a short window of return and pickup of its intrepid explorers. The group had to work fast because a winter season filled with 200-mile-an-hour winds and ice-packed snow was just around the corner.
Over the next few months, Mawson began preparing his team for the scientific work ahead. He formed 8 3-man exploration parties, assigning each group a different area to chart and explore. Mawson named his 3-man group the Far Eastern Party. Since Mawson got the first pick for his kickball team, he selected 25-year-old Xavier Mertz, a Swiss mountaineer and Olympic champion skier. He also selected Belgrave Nennis, a 23-year-old decorated Special Army soldier, for his party. This group intended to travel 350 miles into the eastern heart of the continent's coastline. Each group included 2 sleds pulled by dog teams made up of 12 huskies. Their sleds were packed with all the necessary survival equipment and supplies needed for the men and dogs. It was determined that each man would receive 23 ounces of rations per day, and their primary food source was cans of pemmican, which some have described as a tastier version of Spam. The dogs were given dried seal meat. Their outer clothing, which was considered modern for the time, consisted mostly of hand-knitted wool, waterproof canvas, and reindeer skin boots. They also had fur-lined hoods that they wore under helmets. Just imagine a modern-day rap music video. But unlike in the climate-controlled music video, their team's biggest concern was preventing frostbite. Throughout the winter, the men made short training trips, setting up ice caves and planting flagpoles on hills to help identify locations of supplies and shelter. One such cave was named Aladdin's Cave because of the way it filtered the light, making the walls appear blue and green. By November of 1912, Mawson called all the teams together and made sure each one of them knew the ship, the Aurora, would be back in Commonwealth Bay to pick them up on January 15, 1913. Mawson warned each team January 15th was the date they needed to be back and ready to return home. The ship only had a short window of time to depart because they risked being locked in by ice for another 12 months. It took Mawson and his 3-man crew, the Eastern Party, several extra days to cross 2 glaciers because of high ice winds and hidden crevasses. Wind gusts ranged from 30 miles per hour to the strongest recorded winds at 200 miles per hour. Average temperatures sit around negative 50 degrees Fahrenheit or Celsius, your choice. Wind chill temps dip down even more. To make matters worse, Ninnis came down with a case of snow blindness, which is brought on by the sun reflecting off the snow and into your eyes. Some describe it as feeling like rubbing sand across the surface of your pupil. Some days, the team never left their tents due to the excruciating, harsh conditions and were making far less progress than Mawson had hoped. He was continually racing his team against the looming deadline of Aurora's return. As the group became accustomed to the weather, they started to fall into a daily pattern. Mertz would travel ahead on skis, scouting for any visible black holes of death. They'd save up their lunch rations each day, sharing them during their late afternoon tea break. Then in the evening, all three team members would help feed the dogs and prepare the tent. Before going to sleep, they'd each write in their diaries, including small messages to their wives and girlfriends and family in the event that they didn't survive. Tweeting and texting wouldn't be an option for another 100 years. So our explorers had to save up all their messages for a one-time delivery, which would take place 1 year in the future. It was definitely the generation of patience and delayed gratification. According to Mawson's journal, they decided to leave behind one sled carrying excess supplies. The logic was they could move faster during their last few weeks to make their deadline. The date was December 12th. Leaving behind a supply sled would turn out to be a poor decision. But it wouldn't be their only deadly mistake. As they continued their journey, they loaded up their remaining supplies into a single sled. Because of all the extra weight, they had to use all their best dogs to pull it. By this point, they were traveling single file, with Ninnis on the supply sled in the third position, pulling up the rear. Traveling this way would provide them with ample warning, and they wouldn't jeopardize losing their supplies needed to keep them alive.
According to Mawson's diary, the date of December 14th, 1912, started out as a great day with spirits high. Xavier Mertz was skiing about 30 yards ahead. The sun was shining, and the weather was so pleasant that Ninnis was walking alongside the dog team, pulling the supply sled. Mawson was in the middle, and the upbeat men intended to head back to base camp in 2 days. They were all looking forward to their journey home to their loved ones after an entire year away.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
As the trio traveled, Mertz lifted his ski pole into the air, alerting Douglas and Ninnis that he had just successfully skied across a snow bridge. There was no way of knowing if it was 2 feet wide or 50 feet wide. However, the fact that he'd skied across it was a good sign. Douglas shouted a verbal warning to Ninnis as he steered his lighter sled across the bridge, and he too had equal success. It was then he saw Ninnis crack his whip to push the dogs forward. Douglas stopped and settled his dogs for a moment, and when he looked back up, Ninnis, the sled, and all the dogs had vanished. As Mawson ran back to the snow bridge, all he could see was a gaping chasm. Mertz lowered Mawson into the icy depths using a safety rope to assess the damage. But all Mawson could see and hear was whimpering from one of the dogs. He used binoculars, but was still unable to determine the depth of the crevasse. About 150 feet down, there was an icy ledge that jutted out from the smooth wall. On it, he could see two dogs, but they were both motionless. Next to the dogs was their best tent and their main sack of food. Neither were accessible. Of most concern was that Ninnis was nowhere in sight. They stayed for hours calling his name, and, ironically, the only rope long enough to reach the ledge was lost on the supply sled. After a few hours, they gave up. They were forced to face the bitter truth that Belgrave Ninnis must be dead and that they have lost all their best dogs and the majority of their supplies. Their previous high spirits were now mired in grief. The loss of Ninnis was devastating, as was the loss of their six huskies. The dogs had become an extension of their explorer family. They also had come to terms with the fact that they were facing the likelihood of starvation and possibly death. Douglas took an inventory of a smaller sled and determined that they had lost their main tent, all of their ground cover, dishes, waterproof pants, and helmets, along with all their dog food. They had enough rations to last 10 days, but there was no way that amount of rations would carry them 320 miles to the Aurora. Cape Denson was at least another month away. Douglas came to the difficult decision that they would eventually need to eat the dogs that would inevitably die within weeks. Douglas took longitude and latitude readings to chart the precise location of their friend's final resting place. He marked it as the Black Crevasse on his map. The duo carefully backtracked to the hut, where they had discarded their surplus supplies just 2 days earlier, and decided to feed the worn-out materials and miscellaneous scraps of leather from their gloves and boots to their surviving dog team. Without a tent, they made a makeshift shelter from the two remaining sleds and draped a canvas over the top. It wasn't weatherproof, but it would be their only form of refuge for the next month until they made it back to the base camp. When the first dog died from exhaustion, they decided to feed the skin and carcass to the other dogs. The remaining huskies were so emaciated, there would be very little meat to be harvested from them. Douglas believed the liver from the dogs held the most vitamins and nutrients and offered them the best chance at survival. He offered the majority of this each night to Mertz to help keep his strength up. While it sickened them to eat man's best friend, they knew they had no choice if they wanted to survive. Mawson named each dog in his daily journal as they died. The first dog to perish was George. The men weathered the blizzard conditions. Icicles hung from their faces, and sheets of ice battered their backs. Their progress was slow. The constant thirst and hunger with the lack of relief from the elements began to weaken not only their bodies, but also their minds. It took the two of them several hours each night to just gather enough strength to build their makeshift shelter. Gone were the days where they leisurely enjoyed a late afternoon tea. Every few days, a dog would collapse, and they would move it to the sled to be carried until it either recovered or died. That meant Mertz would ski, and Douglas would walk alongside the dogs that were still able to walk.
After a week of dire conditions, the men began getting sick, and their physical and mental states began to deteriorate. On Christmas Day, Douglas was packing up their gear and removed his woolen hat for the first time in days. Without a tent and proper nightly shelter, he had decided to keep it on for extra warmth. The men realized it had been weeks since they were all able to remove all their gear. When Douglas removed his helmet, a piece of his ear came off with it. Both men were stunned.
Once the shock had worn off, the men began checking their own extremities. Horrified, Mawson touched his other ear and watched a piece of it fall to the ground. Alarmed by this turn of events, Mertz began removing his own helmet. Portions of his beard and skin also flaked away. The skin located around his temples was raw and oozing pus. Both alarmed by their physical condition, they began removing their gloves, socks, and woolen hats. They took turns removing items of clothing and watched as portions of flesh fell to the ground. They decided the cause wasn't due to a lack of proper shelter, or even proper clothing, or inadequate rations. Instead, they figured the diet of canine hadn't agreed with them. They had both morally struggled with their decision to consume the dogs, but that problem was solved on December 28th, when Ginger, the strongest of the pack, collapsed. Mawson laid her on the sled and stroked her fur, murmuring apologies in hopes that he wouldn't have to consume her. But she would later die from exposure and exhaustion. Her empty harness would have brought them both to tears if they had any to cry. However, Douglas was still convinced the best nutritional value could be found in the organ meat. Since Mertz wasn't looking so good, Douglas insisted he eat Ginger's liver. In hindsight, that would be another fatal error. On the morning of December 31st, 1912, Xavier awakened, feeling very sick. His last journal entry stated, "I cannot eat of dogs any longer. Yesterday, the flesh made me feel very sick." Those would be the last words he'd ever write. For 3 more days, he stayed inside his sleeping bag, refusing to consume any more meat from Ginger. Douglas worried because he knew the Aurora would be anchoring in Denson Bay in just a few short weeks. At their current rate of travel and lack of rations, he feared they'd never make it and perish from exposure. Mertz refused to move, saying it was suicide to march in bad weather, while Douglas stated it was suicide to sit and starve to death. While they both made valid points, Mawson ultimately won the argument, and they decided to continue on.
The next day, Douglas strapped Xavier to the sled and pulled it while crawling on his hands and knees for almost 2 miles. When Douglas looked back at his teammate, he could see white frost forming on his face. Fearing his friend was freezing to death, Douglas decided to stop for the day and again dug out another shelter for them. He hoped they'd have better weather the following day, allowing them to travel on their own 2 feet. They were still over 100 miles from base camp.
It had come to the point where Mertz could no longer take care of his own basic needs or hygiene. When Mawson began to clean and change him, Mertz feared he was being prepared for slaughter. He was delirious, challenging Mawson. "Am I a man or a dog? You think I have no courage because I cannot walk? But I'll show you." Then Mertz removed his glove, bit down on his own frostbitten finger, and spit it out onto the ground. Needless to say, things were going south real fast. Mawson remained calm and bandaged his friend's hand and put him back in his sleeping bag to rest. Later, Douglas wrote in his diary, "God help us." The next day, Xavier Mertz never woke up. Douglas Mawson was now alone. Mawson removed Mertz's clothing, packed him in ice, and said a prayer. Then he repurposed Xavier's coat and used it as a sail for the sled. His hope was that the sail would help him push the sled towards Cape Denson. With one less mouth to feed, there was no need to share his rations. Mawson decided he had an additional 10 days worth of supplies if he only ate and drank the bare minimum. But he was in bad shape. His flesh was falling off. His stomach was in knots, and he was suffering from debilitating headaches. To make matters worse, the portions of his skin that hadn't fallen off were now covered in boils. After traveling a few miles alone, he began to feel a strange sensation in his feet. It felt like he was slipping inside of his boots. He decided to sit down and remove his boots to inspect his condition. What he saw was a mass of rotting tissue and flesh. The bottoms of his feet were beginning to separate and fall off. Again, Mawson didn't panic. To remedy the situation, he applied lanolin oil and put on 6 pairs of socks to hold his feet together.
It was now January 15th, and Douglas realized it was more than likely the Aurora was already waiting for him at the base camp. But with winter rapidly approaching, he knew the ship wouldn't wait long. With a renewed sense of urgency, he forged on towards the bay. But Lady Luck wasn't done with our intrepid explorer. He had a few more trials and tribulations to overcome first.
On January 17th, Mawson set out again at the top of a glacier, pulling his sled, which he had now tethered around his waist by a rope. The snow was smooth and the wind at his back, and for once, he felt like he was making some progress. As he moved along, Douglas spotted up ahead the telltale signs of a crevasse. Hoping to navigate around it, he turned north. But he had misjudged the edges and suddenly found himself plummeting into an abyss of nothingness. As he fell, he felt a sharp jerk when his sled got caught on a ledge. Because he was tethered to it, it held him suspended within the ice cave. As he dangled and spun around in this dark chasm, he thought, why continue? I could easily end my suffering with one simple cut of the rope. But he couldn't help but think about his family and his fiance back home. He knew he had to just keep fighting. The rope had been knotted every 12 inches, but the walls of the ice cave were smooth as glass, making it impossible to climb. So Mawson's only hope was to climb up the rope without any leverage from the walls. It was an agonizing 12 inches at a time, using the knots as a temporary perch to rest his feet, the same feet that were being held together by 6 pairs of socks. Miraculously, Mawson managed to slowly inch his way up the rope until he reached the top of the chasm, only to grab hold of an unstable snow bridge, causing him to lose his grip, plummeting him back down into the chasm again. The momentum of his fall dislodged his sled, and it began rocking precariously back and forth. According to a journal entry Mawson would later make, that was precisely the moment he believed it would be the end for him. Thinking of his friends Xavier and Belgrave, Mawson knew he couldn't give up. He had to stay alive so someone could tell their tale. He grabbed hold of the rope, and as it ripped through his hands, he slowly climbed 14 feet to the top, this time with the agility of someone who wasn't emaciated and covered in boils. He managed to thrust his legs out and gain purchase on solid ground. Now, a lot of historians call BS on this portion of Mawson's claims, but it's documented in his diary. So for purposes of accuracy, let's go with allegedly. Allegedly, Mawson woke up an hour later after a short nap and belly crawled for a very long time, terrified that he would fall into another crevasse. But for days, he continued to push forward.
On January 28th, Mawson saw something waving on the horizon. Assuming he was hallucinating, he did his best to ignore it, but eventually, he made his way closer to the anomaly. What he found was miraculous, marvelous good fortune.
It appeared that while Mawson was continuing to fight the elements, his friends back at base camp had sent out search parties for the Far Eastern group. They stacked stones in the shape of a kern and covered it in black cloth as a beacon to anyone who passed by. Inside was a waterproof bag containing dry clothes, food, and other supplies. There was also a note that stated that Aladdin's cave was only 21 miles ahead and that the Aurora was waiting in the bay. All the other exploration parties had already safely returned to the base camp. The time and date recorded at the bottom of the note indicated he had just missed the search party by 6 hours. Although disappointed, he now felt a sense of hope, especially after seeing the array of food and supplies. Before heading out to Aladdin's cave, he made sure to gorge himself on the chocolate and biscuits they'd left. After all he'd been through, I think he certainly deserved it.
It would take Mawson another 4 days before he'd catch sight of the flagpole for Aladdin's cave. Once he finally arrived, he stumbled inside on bloody stumps, relieved, knowing he'd be spending his first night in months inside a walled structure. He was now only a day away from base camp, but the harsh Arctic conditions weren't entirely done with him yet. The following day, he was trapped inside the cave after a powerful icy blizzard came out of nowhere, trapping him inside for 5 days.
With fierce determination, Douglas managed to make it 5 miles from where the Aurora was anchored in Commonwealth Bay, but he was hell-bent on making it back, or die trying. Several hours later, he finally arrived. With frozen tears in his eyes, he spotted the Aurora, but it was sailing away. Had he really come this far, just to miss his ride? He felt utterly defeated, because Douglas was now stranded in the Antarctic. Base camp was still another half mile away, and as he arrived, he anticipated seeing smoke rising from the chimney. But it was quiet. The base camp appeared to be deserted, and everyone, presumably, on the boat heading back home. Still unable to walk, Mawson crawled the last few feet before collapsing. It was then 3 men stood up and began shouting as they ran towards him. He was in such bad shape that he was unrecognizable. They weren't sure who he was. They thought Xavier. They thought Mertz or Ninnis. His entire face was so frostbitten that his skin was black, and his skeletal frame no longer had any resemblance to his former self. After feeding him and tending to his wounds, Mawson told them the tearful story of his 2 team members. The 3 men in turn told him that the ship had indeed just sailed for home, but the 6 men had volunteered to stay behind and search for the missing party. Although the men got on the radio with the Aurora, alerting them that Mawson had arrived, it wasn't able to turn back around because of bad weather. Mawson would have to wait another year in the harshest climate of the world before they would return.
After waiting for almost an entire year, Douglas Mawson finally returned to his native Australian home as a national hero. He also went on to marry his longtime fiancée. It would take decades before Douglas Mawson would understand what had weakened him and his teammate Xavier Mertz. It was in the 70s that scientists would discover that the Far Eastern Expedition members had inadvertently poisoned themselves with a toxic dose of vitamin A caused by consuming dog liver. Years later, Douglas honored his fallen team members by naming 2 icy peninsulas after them. He also set about writing his memoirs, which in many ways helped him come to terms with the guilt he felt over losing his 2 friends. He often found himself wondering why they had perished and he had survived. Had it come down to human endurance and the will to live? Or had it been a nod from Lady Luck that helped Mawson survive his deadly misadventure?
silence with blindness. Through darkness, I'll walk with you. When time's up, when they find us, I promise I'll be with you. For guiding, I'm calling in the garden. I wait for you. Put all my hope in you. What is a man supposed to do? Hunger in my eyes, I'll stand up close to you.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.